Call the Healthcare Subcommittee on Health Policy to order. We have on the agenda today a work session on House Bill 3017. I just want to let everyone know we won't be working that bill today. We're waiting on amendments, but that will be back. And with that, I will open up a public hearing on House Bill 2927. And Sandy, what do we have before us today?
Madam Chair, thank you. What we have before us on House Bill 2927, which is sponsored by Representative Cannon and Representative Grulich, this bill is establishing a task force on anatomical gift donation. It requires that the governor appoint the members of the task force. It also provides that the specific issues to be discussed by the task force and that the task force report its findings and recommendations or potential legislation to the appropriate interim committee by October 1st, 2008. This has an emergency clause and is effective on passage.
Thank you, Sandy.
Chair, can I ask Sandy a question about something I just heard today? Sandy, I heard that all the task force bills don't go to Ways and Means, that there's another committee that has a pot of money for all the task forces and that...
Oh, really?
Okay. I must have heard that wrong.
I have not heard that, but that would be really...
It's the first time I ever heard
that.
Is it the House Administration Committee or something?
Is it the Legislative
Administration
Committee? It might be, sir.
That things go to Legislative Administration that are task forces, and there's a... All the task forces you pass compete against each other for a certain pot of money?
And maybe a point of clarification that might help differentiate. It generally, I would think one of the considerations on that is who staffs the task force. If it's a legislatively staffed task force, then it goes to us. If it's staffed by an agency, then that's where...
Then go to Ways and Means.
Or they would generate a fiscal on it that then the committee would look at or not, or something like that. What I did not look at closely is who DHS is allocated to provide staff in support of this task force, so it would be a their staff would be backing.
Versus thing, legislative committee service.
Correct.
Thank you.
Oh, thanks for the question. Representative Cannon, would you like to come up and get us started? And Representative Greenlink, did you want to make comments as well?
Nope.
Just Representative Cannon? All right.
Freshman.
And I will be right back, and Representative Bonamici is going to play the album for a few minutes.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. Very good to see a little of how the other subcommittee operates. I'm Ben Cannon, representing House District 46, here to say a few words about House Bill 2927 before introducing a panel of folks who will be able to tell you a whole lot more about this issue. This was brought to my attention by one of the gentlemen who you'll hear from, a constituent, Brent Jacobs, who I think will express his concern about some areas of the anatomical gift industry, the lack of regulation and oversight of that, and the perhaps improper activities occurring in that segment of the industry. I think none of us are here to say that there is anything wrong with anatomical donation in general. In fact, entirely the opposite. I come here as certainly a strong supporter of organ donation, organ banks, and the appropriate sort of scientific use and medical use of those organs. We do want to make sure, however, that I certainly want to make sure that that industry operates responsibly, operates with integrity, and operates honestly. And that's why we have proposed a task force on anatomical gift donation that would investigate what's happening in this industry, including the sort of less regulated or unregulated parts of it. In section 1, sub 2 of the bill, line 14 through 28, you can get a sense of the kind of issues that this task force would be charged with studying. I think our expectation would be that they might come back to a subsequent legislature with recommendations on regulatory changes, statutory changes that might be required. So with that, I think I will end my testimony. Certainly happy to answer any questions, but would suggest that the real experts will follow me.
Thank you, Representative Cannon. Are there any questions for Representative Cannon? Yes, Representative Gelser.
Thank you, Madam Vice Chair. I did have one question. On line 29, there's a word that jumps out to me. It says the task force may hold hearings and subpoena witnesses. And I was wondering if you knew of a context of another task force that had subpoena power, or if And what is a subpoena from a task force?
Madam Chair, Representative Gelzer, it's a good question. I don't know how this language got into it, whether it's common for all task forces. I suspect not. I think we may have a situation where there are potentially people who would be, you know, would be nice to talk to, who may not really want to talk to this task force. Whether that suggests we should have the power of, the task force should have the power of subpoena, I really don't know. I think we'd have to ask legislative counsel that question.
Thank you. Any other questions? Representative Flores.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Representative Cannon, thank you very much. This is an interesting concept. Now, do I recall you saying that the purposes for which you bring this bill are because there have been problems, or that we'll hear the rationale from other advocates here?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Flores, thank you for the question. I think that I will save primary explanation of the rationale for the witnesses that follow me. However, we are concerned about portions of an industry that receive less regulatory scrutiny than other portions, and the alleged, and I would have to say alleged because I haven't spent a lot of time in this field, I haven't seen it myself, but the alleged misdeeds going on in that portion of the industry. So I think you'll hear more about specific concerns from subsequent witnesses. There is rationale for bringing this bill, and I think you'll hear it from them.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Representative. Okay, and we have excuse me, Representative Greenlick.
Incidentally, I've heard some horror stories about this. Will curl my hair. I'd like to ask a question. It's embarrassing to ask a question since my name's on the bill. Would you go to line 11 on the first page and tell us what an enucleator is? If I'm saying that correctly, I think I am.
Madam Chair, a member of the committee, my only reference point for this word is the hearing we had on stem cells yesterday, which Ooh. Talked about enucleated cells, which lacked a nucleus. Now, I don't think we're proposing that this task force should contain cells lacking nucleuses. So I am,
or even a person lacking.
So I will have to defer that to a dictionary or perhaps
like a new movie.
We appreciate your candor, Representative Cannon, and I did see some smiles and some head shaking in the back of the room, and perhaps our next panel will clarify this for
us. Yeah, we may hear what it is.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. We have Mr. Jacobs, Mr. Bartlett, and Mr. Seeley. Correct. We have three chairs here, so please join us. Welcome, and I'll let you decide who wants to go first. If you have an appointed leader, go right ahead.
Well, since he mentioned my name. Chairman, members of the committee, this is the first time for me, so please bear with me. My name is Brent Jacobs.
Thank you. I was going to say, please start by saying your name. Thank you.
I reside at 2432 North Schofield Street in Portland, and I'm currently the manager of Oregon Funeral Service, also in Portland, where I've been there for 4.5 years. I'm definitely speaking in support of this legislation that will help regulate and govern the anatomical donation programs and facilities in Oregon by creating this task force. I think it's extremely important. And to this point, most people probably are going to learn a whole lot today. It's a business where, you know, people don't want to know a lot of times. Unfortunately, it's definitely serious. The formulation of a task force on anatomical gift donation is necessary for a variety of reasons, namely to assure for the complete and total respect for the donors, protection of the donor's family, accountability of all donated body parts, regulation of the relationships between funeral homes or crematories and the donation facilities, and to oversee the administration of these facilities and the credentials of the employees thereof. Being in my particular job in the death care industry, I am in a unique position to see every aspect of the business, including the apparent inappropriate and unethical relationships between some funeral homes and some anatomical donation facilities, as well as the more gruesome and disrespectful tasks that take place behind closed doors, away from public knowledge and without any government supervision. One of my responsibilities on a daily basis is to ensure that my staff, which deals with dozens of funeral homes and several hundreds of decedents and their families each month, maintains the highest level of respect and compassion for each and every decedent in our care. With that in mind, and the fact that my company has several medical examiner accounts where we see the most gruesome and graphic scenes imaginable, I must say that I am horrified by what I have encountered in the anatomical donation industry. That's pretty bad. I will warn you that I will be speaking about some potentially disturbing subjects today as they are part of my job and what I witness while on the job, and because they definitely pertain to my testimony here today. We are not just dealing with a few parts that are taken from a body and a last compassionate act of giving. Let me be clear that this is a much larger issue than that. We're dealing with the wholesale stripping of any and every piece of human tissue that can possibly make a buck. We're dealing with human beings being viciously and carelessly torn apart by unlicensed and unregulated workers. We're dealing with your loved one's stripped carcasses, such as their decapitated heads and extraneous extremities, being shoved into a cardboard box like the poor victims at Buchenwald or Dachau, and similarly sent to the local crematory for disposal. These facilities must be regulated. The employees that work at these facilities must be accountable to someone. And most importantly, the decedents must be treated with the utmost respect. This task force can help make that happen. In addition, there is so much money to be made from these assorted body parts that there is a very obvious potential for serious foul play. A family might be told that certain organs will be taken from their loved ones for research or to even help someone out, but who's to say what parts are actually taken? The next time the family sees their loved one, they've been cremated and come in a little box. They'll learn. Who knows? The next time the family sees their loved one, they're in a box. Untold parts could have been taken and untold profits could have been made from these parts. There's really no accountability. But the possible breach of ethics due to the possibility of making a buck from these parts doesn't stop there. In fact, as I speak, there are actually a few funeral homes that are actively involved in the solicitation of the anatomical donation industry for money directly to the families who have just lost a loved one at the funeral home. Any company dealing in human remains and anatomical parts should be licensed by the state, and the employees of these firms operating on the human donors should be licensed as well. Another extremely important point to make is that all funeral home employees who meet with families and make arrangements, and their embalmers who do far less operating on decedents than at any of these anatomical donation facilities, are all licensed by the state. They are also accountable to the Oregon Mortuary and Cemetery Board. These same standards need to be applied to the anatomical donation industry. I'm not saying that the Oregon Mortuary and Cemetery Board is the right body for that, but I'm saying they have to be regulated. They need to be accountable to someone. These anatomical donations are very much needed for research and sometimes to be given to help sick or debilitated patients. It has the potential to be a wonderful industry, but I believe I have brought forth the necessary examples today as to why the anatomical donation industry and the people involved in the industry must be monitored by the state. Every Oregonian, even deceased Oregonians, need dignity and respect. The task force will significantly help in achieving this very basic right. And after these gentlemen do what they do, I'll be more than happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, Mr. Jacobs.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. Thanks for sharing. Sorry, do we want to? Why don't we do the whole panel and then we'll do questions? That'd be great.
Madam Chair and members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity to testify on HB 2927. My name is Michael Seeley. I'm the Executive Director of the Pacific Northwest Transplant Bank, which is the federally designated organ procurement organization responsible for organ recovery in Oregon, Southern Washington, and Southwestern Idaho. We work in concert with the Lions Eye Bank of Oregon, the Community Tissue Services here in Oregon, and our public education arm, Donate Life Northwest. I'm here, as my colleagues are here, to support the establishment of the task force as prescribed in HB 2927. We strongly hold that transparency is essential to our collective service to the people of Oregon in the arena of organ, tissue, and eye donation. In the last year, there have been isolated events of fraudulent activity in other areas of the country that have had potential for adverse effects on those awaiting transplantation. Each of these events violated federal law and FDA regulations. Each event was discovered, and the individuals involved were prosecuted to the full extent of the law. Organ, tissue, and eye recovery organizations are regulated by the federal government. The Pacific Northwest Transplant Bank is overseen by the Health Resources Services Administration, HRSA, and the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services, CMS. The Pacific Northwest transplant is also required to be registered with the Food and Drug Administration. Community Tissue Services and the Lions Eye Bank of Oregon are registered and regulated by the FDA. All three organizations submit high standards of accreditation in our respective fields. In the area of anatomical gifts solely designated for research and study, no state or federal oversight exists. Whole body donation for study at the state medical school is conducted in accordance with well-established policy and procedure within academic settings. Oregon has multiple non-academic, freestanding, for-profit, and not-for-profit companies engaged in whole body donation for research and study. Currently, these groups are not subject to any oversight. We support the formation of a task force that would comprehensively review all circumstances of donation services and make recommendations to the legislature that is timely in fashion to ensure transparency and affirm the public's trust. Thank you for the opportunity to present testimony, Madam Chair, and the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Seeley. Ms. Bartlett?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Chris Bartlett. I reside at 13963 Southeast 141st Avenue in Clackamas, Oregon. I'd like to begin by thanking you for your time and consideration in this matter. I would like to continue just by stating that I support the proposed legislative measure. Furthermore, I'd like to add to some key points that my colleague Brent Jacobs has already mentioned. I'd like to preface my statements just by letting you know that I currently hold a funeral director's and embalmer's license in the state of Oregon. I'm a small business owner. I own a trade embalming service and also am a crematory manager for Oregon Funeral Service. A couple of points that I want to add to Brent's testimony as to why I feel a task force would be important. They're kind of synonymous, but the first thing I feel it's important is accountability for anatomical donation companies. As you are already aware, there's no current state statutes that regulate the Oregon anatomical donation companies. This is something that must take place. As a licensed funeral director and embalmer in the state since 1994, I am very familiar with state regulations relating to the death care industry. To become a licensed funeral director and embalmer, I attended Mount Hood Community College, where I received an associate's degree in applied science with funeral service education. Once I completed the program, I was then required to pass either a national exam or the Oregon State exam for funeral director as well as embalming practices. I currently pay $160 every year to sustain this license. With donation companies, they have personnel that are known as what they call cutters. they're responsible, as you can imagine, for the dissection of the body. They have no real training or licensing requirements and can essentially be anyone that might find the job interesting. I feel that it is an injustice to the public that this type of thing can take place with no regulation from a state agency. If you consider what I do as an embalmer and what a donation company does, they have far more exposure to biohazard material such as blood and tissue. In addition, I currently pay $350 annually to sustain my license for my small business. Every 2 years, I'm susceptible to inspection by the Oregon State Mortuary Board. This inspection is to ensure that I've kept correct records and my preparation room is kept clean and sanitary. I understand the purpose of these inspections and feel they are necessary. Because there are no statutes pertaining to anatomical donation companies, they have been allowed to perform business without any regulation. To summarize, I feel that if every funeral home in the state of Oregon must be licensed and regulated by the state for their death care services that they provide, then the anatomical donation companies should be no different. In addition, to my knowledge, Oregon currently has three donation companies, Community Tissue Services, BioGift, and MedCure. I just wanted to give one small example of maybe a larger problem that can take place, particularly with anatomical donation companies.
and performing cremations for Medcare on behalf of a local funeral home, I had discovered that the director of Medcare had actually been witnessing the cremation authorizations. Upon further reviewing the paperwork, I discovered that the wrong person had actually signed the cremation authorization. Oregon state statutes are very specific as far as who has the right to sign this, and the son of the deceased had signed the authorization rather than the spouse. I contacted Medcare to get the correct authorization received from Medcare. My phone call initially was the director really didn't seem like he cared. It kind of wasn't his problem, but he said he would take care of the situation. 2 weeks later, after numerous phone calls, I finally received the correct cremation authorization. And as you're probably aware, if the cremation had taken place, the spouse came back later and said, you know, I didn't authorize that. That could create a huge potential problem. So my point is that I called the State Mortuary and Cemetery Board and I said, what can I do? The wrong person signed the cremation authorization. This is happening a lot. The response was is that we can't do anything. These folks aren't regulated by the state. They're not regulated by anybody. And we can't do anything at all. So that can potentially have some huge repercussions just in that self alone. That's just one small instance. So to summarize once again, I feel that if every funeral director and embalmer or apprentice in the state requires licensing and formal training, then an anatomical donation company personnel should be held to that accountability as well. The second point and the last point I'd like to make is ethical practices. In the funeral industry, we pride ourselves on ethical practices and respect for the deceased. In my experience, anatomical donation companies lack both of these. I feel these companies are not truthful with families or prospective clients as to what will exactly take place with the remains. I feel that if families truly understood that their family member would be dismembered and sold to various associations for practice, they would never choose donation to begin with. They are misled through slogans such as the one given by Medcare. To quote their slogan, to support your support, your support for finding a cure. That their family member is doing just that, if they're helping find a cure, not being sold for doctors to practice in the latest cornea transplants. It is disturbing to think that while donation companies reap the benefits of profits attained from selling these parts, that the only compensation that the family is to receive is a, quote, free cremation. I would like to close by simply stating that history shows that a company that is not regulated in some degree has the potential to spiral out of control. If the anatomical donation industry is allowed to go unregulated, the long-term complications will be very harmful to families of donors as well as the state of Oregon. Once again, I'd like to thank you for your opportunity to testify today. At this point, I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, Mr. Bartlett, and thank you, gentlemen, and I want to thank Representative Cannon for bringing this forward. This is a really interesting piece of legislation. And questions for the panel? Representative Bonamici, and then...
Thank you, Chair Kotek. I'm going to direct my question to Mr. Seeley because you raised an issue that I want to follow up on, and that's the existence of federal regulations. And I'm trying to figure out where...
Yes.
What falls under federal regulation and what doesn't, because you say that there's been even some federal prosecution. So... if you could just sort of explain that, it looks like maybe organs that are being donated for a transplant are governed by federal law, but everything else isn't. And I don't know if I'm correct in that assumption.
Madam Chair, Representative Bonamici, there are two domains here that I think we need to clarify. The Pacific Northwest Transplant Bank, the iBank, and Community Tissue Services are regulated by the federal government. There's a huge layering of requirement that these organizations need to meet in order to provide organs and tissue for transplantation in people. Now, if you could then the next domain are and the anatomical companies that referred to in testimony here who have nothing to do with transplantation, not the taking of gifts, and they're not being transplanted in people. It's not a medical procedure. Bodies are donated for science, and they are, the term is disarticulation, and they have clients throughout the country in which they provide anatomical specimens for various trainings. And unfortunately, as been pointed out, there is no way of knowing who their client base is. And organ and tissue transplantation, the transplantation of the cornea, of tissues for transplanted organs, every single organ donated is tracked for its entire life. Every test that has to be performed for infectious disease is reviewed. We also submit to a very rigorous accreditation process that shores up that regulatory process by the federal government. We are visited on a routine basis. We don't have the luxury of every couple years they come. They can walk through the door tomorrow unannounced, and we are prepared to ensure that our policies and procedures are in concordance with the federal oversight. So we're talking about two separate domains. The fraudulent activity that occurs is if you have one area that's wholly unregulated, we don't know what they're doing and what will end up where. The fraud case you might have known, remember Alistair Cook? Remember, was it Masterpiece Theater? Mr. Cook died at age 95.
Yeah.
He died of cancer. A gentleman who had broken the law by manipulating the records to say that Mr. Cook had died at 85 of a heart attack. And that bone, which was not consented for donation, but was taken from a, you know, from a setting, was found its way into the transplant system. It was detected, and there was prosecution. Turns out it was a pretty much a mafia thing in New York that was going on, and they'd found a way to do that. But what it raises concern is that if you have an area that's unregulated, there's no oversight. I had the opportunity over the last 3 years to bring this to the Secretary of Health and Human Services at a federal level to see if the FDA would step in and start to regulate that part of the industry, and it's not happened. I think if a state has the courage to take this on as a task force to look at it, we'd be precedent setting. And the reason they're here is because they don't have oversight. The reason they're here in Oregon is because we have a high incidence of cremation. So it's perfect. So I hope that describes the differences in the domains. And just a clarification, the Community Tissue Services is a regulated tissue transplant organization. It's separate from the groups that we're referring to, MedCure and BioGift.
Right. I think we're going to hear more about this in the next bill we look at as well.
Representative. Thank you, Madam Chair. A couple of questions. But I'll put one, my second question first. Now, are you primarily focusing on those instances where there is cremation as opposed to full body burial?
I'll let you guys answer that.
To my knowledge, the bodies that we're referring to, and I would like to support his comments about the difference between bodies that are donated for items going to be used for transplant. Yes, they're very well regulated, and it's like CTS here in the room. They're excellent. The bodies that come back from them are, you know, can be prepared for viewing and for burial. Bodies that are given to BioGift and MedCure are worse than anything that you've ever seen in a horror movie. I mean, these people are just shredded. Literally, and there will never be a viewing. I mean, they have taken every organ, any bone, any tissue that they want, and there's just pieces. It's waste. It's scrap. It's floor sweepings from a butcher shop.
Thank you. Follow up.
But they would require cremation.
Yeah,
correct.
You wouldn't. They do not ever go back to the family or to the funeral home to be buried. They're always cremated. Absolutely.
Then in that context,
so it eliminates the evidence.
That wraps to the bottom of the first page of your testimony, Mr. Jacobs. So where does this violation of that human corpse take place? Is it where a body is supposed to be prepared for the family to have a last viewing? Where does this happen?
No, thank you. That's an excellent question. Thank you. No, it's happening at their facilities. Now, BioGift and MedCure actually have their own facilities. Now, a person dies, and they go to the funeral home. You know, the funeral home goes and picks up the body. And then when the family comes in and meet with the funeral home, it's not always like Oregon donor program. It's not these people. It's people that are getting talked into donating their loved ones to science at the funeral home level a lot of times, directly. And it's also, the unethical part is that it's so the funeral home can make money. And so that these body donation by anatomical part places are making money. And off of these the loved ones of the decedent, which is just unforgivable. So then the family wants to help science. You know, they're it's a ruse. I mean, they're saying that, you know, they're going to find a cure. What cure are you going to find when all they're going to do is they cut his head off for a dentist to use to practice the next teeth pulling method or cut his feet off for a podiatry convention? This really happens. This is not a joke.
Okay, Madam Chair, thank you. So if the discussion is had or the arrangement is made between the funeral home and Medicare mm-hmm. or whoever, a anatomical recipient or receiver entity, so they have a corpse and somebody's died, they have a corpse, and usually isn't there an embalming process that's done at the funeral home?
Not only if they're going to be viewed or, you know, before a funeral and then buried usually, but no, the loved ones might actually have a viewing, but there won't be any embalming, so they can use the pieces for, well, I guess they'll embalm or, you know, some of the pieces that they may take off at the facilities, but the body's whisked away and taken to Medicare or BioGift, which are, you know, usually just they're in a warehouse, basically, you know, in a business park, and they just slice and dice and it's pretty quick and short order, and then they give the pieces back to a crematory, a local crematory.
I did see a series, I mean a segment of The Sopranos that had something like this going on. Madam Chair, one last thing. Mr. Bartlett, you're a licensed embalmer, so can you tell us what an enucleator is?
An enucleator, in reference, an enucleator, for example, which I hold a certificate in enucleation, you receive training in removing the eye for cornea transplant. That's what an enucleator does.
Okay. Thank you.
Representative Gelson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. When families make the choice to donate the bodies of their loved ones to science, are they, what kind of a consent are they signing? Are they aware that the body is going to be disarticulated and the pieces spread apart and gone to different places, and that there won't be a lot of remains when it comes time to cremation, or is that something that they're not aware of?
Madam Chair, Representative Gisler. It's unclear what families are informed about, and I think that's a central issue that a task force could look at. What's informed consent? In other words, there's direct marketing that goes on here in retirement homes. It's in Willamette Week. They'll solicit directly free cremation in return for donation to science. I don't know what their consent forms look like. I don't know that they stand up to the basic elements in informed decision making, which there are some basic elements that, for example, in transplantation we follow. So I think, for example, personally, I'm not against research. I think it's through research that we learn. But those conducting these activities need to be accountable for everything that they do, for infectious disease, the transport of the bodies, informed decision making by families. What are families told? Do they understand the full nature of the gift? That everything will be utilized for science, and I think the agencies have a responsibility to be accountable for where those gifts go, who utilizes those gifts, what's the disposition of those gifts after they've been utilized, and what's the final disposition of the loved one's remains. All of those pieces are now amorphous. I mean, it's just not covered. So,
thank you. Recently, there was a story in the Portland News about an individual who was, I forget if he was homeless, but he lived in poverty. They couldn't find family members, and his body, as a result, was sent from the funeral home and his body donated for science. Are there issues when there are people who die on the streets or people who are very poor and don't have family members? Are there problems with some funeral homes sending those bodies off, making these anatomical gifts and profiting off of that? Is that a problem?
No, that's usually at the county at the medical examiner level. They're usually the ones that are notified and decide what the disposition of the body is. So that's very rare occurrence usually.
testing. Quite often, we receive phone calls from the medical examiner's office. We actually will cremate the individual for the medical examiner's office when they can't find a next of kin. But there are certain steps that they're required to take by state law. They're actually, one of the requirements is they have to contact the medical school and see if they will accept this person for body donation. If they're declined, then that's where we would come into play, where we're contacted and we handle the cremation for the medical examiner's office. And then the medical examiner keeps the person's cremated remains. And that can be forever. They are allowed to, state law does require you to dispose of the cremated remains, at a cemetery or something similar to that. But that does happen quite often. If the person is accepted for a body donation, then typically what will happen, because there is no next of kin, their body is sent to the medical, to Mount Hood Community College, where the funeral service students will embalm the person. And then from there, they're taken to Oregon Health Sciences University, where they're donated for science. So that, OHSU, along with CTS, in my opinion, are the two most respectable anatomical donation companies. I'm strictly referring to BioGift and MedCare as the two problem areas, I think, with the state of Oregon.
Thank you. I have a couple comments. I think the topic here is well worth pursuing, and the makeup of the task force might need some tweaking, because it gives the impression when we have, for example, a recipient of an anatomical gift donation, we're not talking about that. So maybe we can tighten this up in terms of the types of anatomical body part distribution, selling, whatever, that we're trying to regulate. And we also have Mr. Coach? With the Mortuary and Cemetery Board. I was wondering if you could come up for a moment. And thank you, gentlemen.
Thank you.
Really appreciate your testimony. Coach?
Good afternoon.
Can you say your name for the record?
Madam Chair and members of the committee, my name is David Coe. I'm the Executive Director of the Oregon Mortuary and Cemetery Board. I didn't come prepared to testify. I came in the event that you might have questions, but I should say that I personally support the notion of establishing a task force, and I can confirm just about everything you've heard from the previous witnesses, and could certainly add to the parade of horror stories that you've heard. I don't think you need that at this point. So I will just be prepared to answer any questions you might have.
Thank you. Have you had a chance to look at the bill?
Not closely, Madam Chair.
Thank you. And I will follow up with Representative Cannon on the content of the makeup of the task force, but it struck me that it might be helpful to have someone from OHSU or maybe even someone from the industry on the task force. I don't know what your thoughts would be about that.
Madam Chair, I think those are pretty good suggestions. Perhaps someone from the Mortuary and Cemetery Board, and perhaps someone from the Medical Examiner's Office. I'm not sure, but I agree with you that it may be a good idea to look at who the stakeholders or players are in the sort of a task force. I would like to go back to something, a question that arose with regard to subpoena power. And in this instance, it may be wise for this task force or some related entity to have subpoena power. The current state of the law with respect to the Mortuary and Cemeteries Board's jurisdiction provides that these entities are exempt from our regulation. So I've looked at it 1,000 different ways and talked with our AG and trying to find what parts of it can we regulate and what can we not regulate. But it says that the law says that the provisions of this chapter shall not apply to, and so it's just about everything in our regulatory or organic statute doesn't apply. Nevertheless, when Medcure, as I understand it, is doing more business than BioGift, and there are human remains being flown into Oregon from all around this country, not just a few, a lot, and that's a very expensive proposition. So it seems to me that Medcure must be relatively well funded, but these remains are flying in, and there is no regulation. And I felt obligated to see if I couldn't find something else, something out about Medcure. I had talked with Walt Mitchell at BioGift. And he was part of a group, and we talked, and he talked with a number of people, and he at least is someone whose face you can see, and so on. Anyway, I wrote or called and said, I'm with the Mortuary and Cemetery Board. I think that we probably have very little regulatory authority over the kind of business you're operating, but it would be very helpful if you would send me a letter that explaining what it is you do and how you do it, and I think we have an interest, a legitimate interest, in asking those kinds of questions. And what I received was an envelope with a copy of a promotional brochure, the kind of a promotional brochure that someone who from whom they're looking for a donation might get, and they just stonewalled. And so my impression is that given the opportunity to voluntarily come forward and explain what you do, I don't think that may happen. At least it's been my experience, and I don't know whether it's proper for this task force to have subpoena authority, but I think it's probably true that without that, the people who the task force might be interested in may indeed be unwilling to cooperate and provide information, and that's one of the problems with the whole activity in the first place.
Thank you. That's helpful. Yes, Representative Greenlee?
Have you had a chance to review 3092?
Chair Kotek, Representative Greenlee, I have not. I was here today for another hearing, and I knew this was coming up, and I thought I'd better be here.
Yeah. Well, we appreciate you being here. Representative Flores?
Thank you, Madam Chair. You made mention that these two organizations have body parts being flown in from all over, so they are a repository for body parts. And what are they warehousing them to market them to other entities? Where are these body parts?
Chair Kotek, Representative Flores, it's not body parts that are being shipped in. Whole bodies are being shipped in. Those bodies then go to a processing center, and where they the terms used are harvest or procure. They harvest various body parts and tissues, and then those this is a very complex network. Those tissues, what happens here is the procurement of those parts from whole bodies. Those parts are in turn purchased by brokers that work nationally and internationally. Those brokers, and there may be more than one broker, it's not just that there's one broker, there could be several brokers. Those brokers in turn somehow sell those body parts once again to the end user. So it could be the procurement agency, a series of brokers, and then an end user. And then, of course, the question becomes, once the end user has used this tissue for whatever reason, what becomes of the tissue? What becomes to the human head, becomes of the human heads, and what becomes of the torsos? And I could get more graphic, but I think you see, to put this, maybe one way to explain the seriousness of this is to look at the complete 180 degree opposite, which would be the OHSU whole body donation program, where medical students study medicine using cadavers. And it's very respectful to the extent that once the semester is completed and the bodies are no longer necessary, OHSU has a service, and they invite the family. The bodies are cremated once they've been used for science or educational purposes. The bodies are cremated, and then those students get together with the families to share a sort of celebration over this gift, and it's a wonderful thing. So it's just the absolute most decent thing a human being can do on the one hand. That's on one end of the spectrum, and then we have these horror stories on the other end of the spectrum. And I think one of the concerns is that unless there is some regulation of the horrible part of it, it may have negative impacts on the side of this anatomical gift giving that is most noble, and we don't want that to happen.
And just for clarification, thank you. And so the bodies are being shipped to these two entities who are harvesting or doing whatever, and perhaps I misunderstood you. Are they coming in from out of state, or are these just from all over Oregon where the bodies are?
Chair Kotek, Representative Flores, they're coming in from all over the country, out of state into Oregon, from the East Coast and all over.
It's a processing plant, period.
It is a processing plant.
The product is human remains.
Right.
Representative Brune.
Well, a couple questions. Thank you, Madam Chair. And that last point raises another question. Why are they coming from around the nation to Oregon? Is it because Oregon is different from most states as far as regulation goes, to your opinion?
Chair Kotek, Representative Brune, I really don't know. Someone mentioned lack of regulation, but this lack of regulation is not peculiar to Oregon.
Okay.
There is lack of regulation around the country, and I think there's a gentleman here who may have the answer.
He's not. Just state your name again.
Mike Seeley from the Transplant Bank, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Clearly, they're picking. All of these groups started out of one group in Arizona. Walt Mitchell came from Arizona from a group, and they saw the business potential and the business model. They targeted states where they knew there absolutely was no oversight from a mortuary regulatory process, from a state health agency, and of course they have no federal oversight whatsoever. And they target states where there seems to be, and I may be misspeaking, so forgive me, about a higher rate of cremation that occurs in this state, may or may not. And that might be a falsehood, and I don't want to offend my colleagues in the funeral home business.
Yeah, nice.
But it's very specific, so that they can target those areas, and they work sort of under the radar. And the bodies are shipped in under various rites of pre-embalming. For example, I know that funeral homes in Florida will arrange, because they'll offer this free cremation if you donate the science. They contract with Medcure, Delta Airlines, ships the body like we would ship anybody. If you shipped a relative back to Ohio or somewhere to go through a funeral process, they are shipped here, just as described, taken to a facility, and the term is actually disarticulation. And they have clients for different skill labs around the country. For example, laparoscopic equipment so that physicians can practice in hotels and large cities where they have conferences, and the broker will order 20 torsos, and that's what it's reprehensible in the sense that there's no oversight of that. We don't know who the broker is. We don't know who the middleman is. We don't know what monies are being exchanged. If you go into any of the other regulated organizations, every single dime is overseen, particularly as a Medicare program. But I
you
think
don't
that
know what happens to those body parts at those conventions when they're done using them.
Well, and I think there's, Madam Chair and Representative,
there are horror stories
like
about that.
I think there's a public health issue.
Mm-hmm.
There's the interstate transportation of disarticulated body parts, and I don't think the public or the people in those companies that handle DHL, FedEx, their bodies in these boxes, and they're not informed of that. So I just think the time has come that someone has to start.
Mm-hmm.
Can I follow on?
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you very much. How do we know what we know then? You're saying it's the interstate transportation of bodies is largely unregulated. You're saying that we don't really know, you know, there might be a health hazard. I would agree with that in those terms. How do we know what we know? I mean, how do we know what's going on in these two companies? I got a follow-up to that. But how do we know what we know? How do we know that there's a problem given the fact that it is unregulated? It seems to be sort of a cloistered group here that's not really telling us what's going on.
Well, Madam Chair, Representative Brune, I'm sorry. A lot of us have been tracking this for a long time. There's anatomists. We've convened a panel for the Secretary of Health and Human Services that brought in anatomists that were very aware of what's gone on. There's an investigative reporter from New York, Annie Cheney, who just has produced a fairly large work on this, where she went undercover to determine what's going on. We've just had an incident, and Dave, I'm not sure if you're aware of this, but DHL, where there was a misdelivery of a box in which the wrong recipient. So I think we have a pretty good idea of what's going on.
Thank you.
Can I just one last and sort of a comment more than when we look at these task force, and once again, based on the testimony, I think it makes eminent sense. However, we're sort of picking on two very specific entities, and I don't know if those entities are here to sort of give their side of the story as well, and I think that's an important part of this. Under any considerations, I'll thank you, Matt.
It's definitely worth following up and as we pursue this. So thank you, gentlemen, for your testimony.
Thank you.
I will follow up with Representative Cannon on how he wants to proceed with the bill. And thank you. With that, we'll close the public hearing on House Bill 2927 and open a public hearing on House Bill 3092. Sandy, what do we have here?
Madam Chair, members of the subcommittee, this is pretty straightforward. This bill adopts provisions of the Revised Uniform Anatomical Gift Act of 2006. I believe in your packet you have -1 amendments and -2s. Those were drafted at the request of Lane Shetterly, who is here to speak to them and the purpose of the bill.
Thank you. Thank you for the summary. And with that, Mr. Shetterly.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
It's good to see you.
Good to see you. With your permission, I'll have Mike Seeley back with me. He's my bona fide expert. I'm really just the vessel here for House Bill 3092. For the record, Lane Shetterly, here in my capacity this afternoon as a member of from Oregon, of the National Conference of Commissioners on Uniform State Laws. They need a new name. We call it the Uniform Law Commission. Just a little bit of background about that to lead you into your discussion about House Bill 3092. The National Conference of Uniform Commissioners on State Laws is a 116-year-old organization that is comprised of members from the 50 states as well as Puerto Rico and the U.S. Virgin Islands, members being lawyers, judges, law professors, appointed variously by the states. In Oregon, we are appointed by the governor. There are four of us from Oregon that represent the state to the Uniform Law Commission, and the Uniform Law Commission meets on a regular basis to adopt and regularly amend and update uniform acts. This is nothing new to Oregon. Oregon has already adopted some 60 uniform acts. You'll find them in the table of contents to the Oregon Revised Statutes. The bill before you amends the Uniform Anatomical Gifts Act, which was itself adopted by Oregon in 1968, as I recall, and has been amended a couple of times since then. As I mentioned, one of the things, apart from adopting uniform acts, the Uniform Law Commission regularly updates and amends acts to keep them current with developments around the country. The system of the Uniform Commission is predicated on the notion that substantial uniformity in laws from state to state facilitate interstate commerce and the transport of goods and services across state lines and make life better for citizens, and that is, I think, clearly seen as an advantage in the bill that's before you today, House Bill 3092, that updates the Uniform Anatomical Gifts Act. Just a couple of other brief comments, having introduced myself to you as a member of the Oregon delegation to the Uniform Commission. There are three others. Carl Bier is a law professor from the University of Oregon. He is a member, again, by governor appointment. Joe Willis, an attorney in Portland at the law firm of Schwabe Williamson, is also a member of the Law Commission. And Oregon Supreme Court Justice Martha Walters is a member of the Law Commission and, in fact, is slated in July to become the first chair of the National Conference from Oregon. So she will be the chair of the National Conference. We're very proud of her for that. I want to thank Representative Greenlick for facilitating the introduction of this and the amendments that you have before you today. I bring this to you, again, not as an expert in the subject matter, but one of the responsibilities that commissioners have on the Uniform Law Commission is to help see through the introduction of uniform laws to the various states. And so that is the capacity in which I bring this before you today. Fortunately, I have an expert with me, and he has brought some compelling witnesses for you today to receive further testimony on the specifics of this bill, but I do commend it to you, and thank you again for both Representative Greenlick for facilitating the introduction of this, and Madam Chair for the opportunity to have this bill heard today.
Thank you, and thank you for your service on the Commission for the State. We really appreciate that. And also for the record, I have, before we hear from Mr. Seeley, any questions for Mr. Sharma? Thank you for being here. We have, I received a fax today from Dr. Karen Gunson with the State Medical Examiner's Office with expressing her full support for House Bill 3092. Mr. Seeley.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Again, I'm Michael Seeley. I'm the Executive Director of the Pacific Northwest Transplant Bank. Our organization works to ensure that life-saving transplants become reality. I come before you in support of 3092 as amended, the 2006 revision of the Uniform Anatomical Gift Act. The bill represents a significant step forward in galvanizing support of an individual's magnanimous decision to donate organs and tissues to save and enhance lives through transplantation. The proposed revision accurately reflects the environment in which the donation process operates and seeks to bring conformity with the Federal National Organ Transplant Act and Medicare regulations. The revision also supports donor registries and upholds individual autonomy by clarifying the binding personal decision for donation. There are several important accomplishments in this revised act. It expands persons other than the donor authorized to make an anatomical gift on behalf of the donor during the donor's lifetime to include a healthcare agent, parent, or guardian. It grants minors who can apply for a driver's license the power to make anatomical gifts. However, the revision does allow either parent to revoke that gift if the minor dies under the age of 18. Provides clearer language regarding one's ability to revoke or refuse to make an anatomical gift. It reinforces an individual's right to make an anatomical gift and prohibits others from changing that decision. First-person consent is substantially strengthened to bar others from amending or revoking a gift or refusal made by the donor. Provides remedies for intentional actions in violation of the Act while retaining immunity for good faith actions under the Act. Strengthens the functionality of the purpose of the registries. Oregon successfully launched its registry just last week on April 2nd, and within the first 4 days we had nearly 1,100 people sign up. Strengthens the cooperation and coordination between procurement organizations and the medical examiner. Harmonizes the Uniform Anatomical Gift Act with federal law, current technology and practice, and advanced medical directives. Successfully integrates the DMV database for a 24/7 access to the procurement agencies. It's very important. House Bill 3092 is timely with its introduction and will bring Oregon in sync with best practices in the arena of organ, tissue, and eye donation. It will allow for further success and make a significant contribution to saving and enhancing lives. I appreciate the opportunity to present this testimony to you.
Thank you. Thank you. So we have two amendments, dash one and dash two. So we need both. Or one.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Yes, they are. You would adopt both of those into the bill.
Okay. Thank you. We heard testimony in another committee last week. Earlier, I'm blanking, but it was another bill about anatomical gifts. And one of the things that was raised around making sure someone wouldn't change a person's decision to donate. Could you talk about a little bit how that reinforces that in this?
Sure. In the bill itself, and I'm sorry I left that by my chair, Madam Chair and members of the committee, there's substantial language in this revision that gives procedure and process for individuals to revoke a gift if they've made that either by indicating it on their driver's license. Thank you. and or, for example, a registry, there's a mechanism for the individual to go back in and change that decision. It still is consistent with the concept that's well substantiated by public opinion of the opt-in system for donation in the United States. It is further, for example, the registry takes that a step further with designated donation, but does provide for mechanisms to revoke that gift. My sense, having watched this for many years and having gone through at least two of the four revisions in my career, that language is greatly strengthened to protect individual rights. And there's a stronger language in this bill as it relates to the individual and their rights. To be a donor, but also to have a mechanism to go in and recuse that decision through procedure. And at the same time, it preserves where we're headed and where we've been headed with success. With my testimony, I took the liberty, I hope that's okay, to add just a little fact sheet on the back of some of the progress that's been made over the last 3 years in organ donation, particularly, where we've experienced a 20% increase in organ donation in the United States in the last 3 to 4 years, and here in Oregon alone, a 19% increase in the last 2.5 years. I also took the liberty to attach the executive summary on one sheet of paper, front and back, of the 2005 Gallup poll, which looks at public attitude and what that public attitude says to us. And this bill, as written, reinforces what the public, it's in sync with what the public's telling us. I think, as you'll recall from other legislation that's been presented, I think 3166, it has actually, it's the opposite direction with opt-out and presumed consent. And clearly, we had mentioned in previous legislation testimony that only one state was looking at that, and that was New York State, and they issued their report on Friday afternoon. And I would be happy to provide that to the previous committee and to you, Madam Chair. And the central issue is they've asked the governor of New York not to implement presumed consent at this time, that they would move forward with the adoption of bills like this. Solely, really, the main reason is reciprocity and justice. Assuming or presuming that someone is a donor where there's no explicit consent and just assuming to recover that gift and use it in a system where that individual may not have access to health care is considered unjust. And I've got some information, very brief, about that I can submit to them.
Chair Merritt, follow up on your question.
Yes, and thank you. I think the other committee would probably find that very interesting. It was House Bill. It's 3160, I think, in the other committee.
This bill talks about anatomical language, but the other bill talks about old anatomical language.
Right.
This is the new. This is where we've been headed for the last 10 years.
Great. Thank you for that update.
Thank you.
Yes, Representative.
You, in answer to the chair's question, you said that this preserves the individual's right to make and to revoke a decision. But I thought I heard you in your testimony saying, I thought that was the question. It also protects that individual's decision from other people changing it. Is that right, would you?
Madam Chair, Representative Greenlee, correct. So that first person consent, for example, the registry that we've just launched is an informed decision. It's a conformed consent form. And what the public tells us, and every Gallup poll that's ever been done and other polls, we don't have just to be dependent on Gallup, that when I say, for example, as an individual, now take my biases out of it because we're working this, that I want to be a donor, I want that to happen. But the practice has been that we would seek
consent. Or that you don't want to be a donor.
Or that I don't want to be a donor, and which becomes problematic with other bills that we've looked at where that's not adequately addressed. I want that wish carried out. Historically, my DIA, my driver's license, my family's been relied on to give that permission. Now we've moved a step closer to where the public wants us to be, and that we can execute a consent form because I've provided that. Therefore, my family can be disclosed to what's going to happen and certainly be enjoined because they have valuable information the agencies will need and allowing for donation and transplant to happen. But it supports my right to be a donor as an individual, and hopefully that will, not just hopefully, it will be carried out now because it's strengthened in language.
Yes.
Madam Chair, and further answer to your question, Representative Greenlicks, I think the language you're looking for would be in Section 7 on page 5 of the printed bill that says, except as otherwise provided in subsection 7 and subject to subsection 6, in the absence of an express contrary indication by the donor, a person other than the donor is prohibited from making, amending, or revoking an anatomical gift of a donor's body. So that is a key element of the protection there.
Thank you. Thanks. And that strikes me as something that's important because when someone makes up their mind, you don't want someone changing it for them. So, thank you. Questions for these for the panel? We have a few more people, and we have another bill, so I'm going to. And I'm guessing we're going to need to sit and I know I will read through this with the amendments, and then I'm not sure what kind of follow up we need on if people are specific because I don't think any of us have had a chance to digest all the changes, but.
That's fine, Madam Chair. If I may, I've got a few other things going in my life.
Absolutely.
If I may be excused, then I'll follow up with you, perhaps, to see what else you want after this hearing, and we'll try and accommodate that.
That would be excellent.
Thank you for taking your time today.
Yep. Thank you.
I'm always happy to see
you, Madam Chair.
Representative Shetterly, who was my mentor in my first my first term, and it was very much appreciated.
You are too kind.
Come back anytime.
Thank you.
Let's call up Rachel Mackey and Mary Jane Hunt. And I would encourage, I know we all have a lot to read, but the summary of the Gallup poll is probably going to be pretty interesting. We talked about some of these results in the other committee. It's pretty interesting to talk about people's ideas about anatomical donations. Just state your name for the record and welcome.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Rachel Mackey, and I'm here from Kansas, but I'm here as an Oregon donor mom. I became a donor mom on December 14th of 2002 when my son passed away in Portland and became an Oregon donor. And I'm here to support this bill and to talk about the importance of honoring those decisions and carrying out people's wishes. My son moved here, he moved away from Kansas because it's Kansas, and then by way of Colorado and California ended up here, and he found his home here, and he loved Oregon, and he was going to school, and he was working, and he was giving to the community. He was volunteering in elementary school, and he made his home here, and he loved it, and he wanted to contribute to the communities where he lived. He made the decision to contribute as an organ donor when he got his organ driver's license. And on his organ driver's license, he did indicate his wish to be a donor. His wish carried out things that were important to him. And it was important to me as his mother, as it was important to the rest of his family, to see his wishes carried out, to see what was important to him actually fall into place and actually occur. We had a lot of support from the community here, and as a result, Nathan was actually the first donor after cardiac death in the state of Oregon, and he was able to donate kidneys, bone tissue. This bill further supports the importance of each of us being able to make that choice for ourselves, to make that decision, to choose to give a gift. Nathan chose to give that gift. He was very clear about it. Had he not been clear about it, I would have had the opportunity, and his father would have had the opportunity, to make that gift on his behalf. And I think we would have known that that would have been what he would have wanted, and we would have followed up with that. I do know that this committee has also been considering a bill which has presumptive consent. And I read that bill, and one of the concerns I had that I don't have with this present bill is that the other bill doesn't really honor a gift. It takes. You know, had that been in effect when my son died, had I not been available to be here, he would have been a donor no matter what anyone wanted. You know, if he had not indicated anything on his driver's license under that bill, he would have presumptively been a donor. And that wouldn't have been his choice. It wouldn't have been my choice. You know, it would have been something that would have happened. The end result would have been good. But we need to preserve our ability to make those choices for ourselves and for our families and not have those decisions made by the government. I just think that this bill does, you know, it just does a lot to support the importance of being able to honor those decisions. Nathan gave to Oregon when he was here. He gave to Oregon in his death, and he continues to give to Oregon. It's important as a mother. It's important as a family member. Because one of the things that is most important when someone that we love dies, and that's to believe that they'll be remembered. And I know that he'll be remembered through his gifts, through himself, and through the work that he did in the community. And I thank you for having some time to be here.
Thank you, Mrs. Mackey. Thank you for coming to visit and to give your testimony and for sharing the story of Nathan's gifts. We really appreciate it. Any questions for Mrs. Mackey? Where in Kansas are you from?
Topeka.
Topeka. Well, you picked good weather, so thank you for being here. And Ms. Hunt.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'm Mary Jane Hunt, Executive Director of Donate Life Northwest, formerly Oregon Donor Program. I'm here in support of this bill, House Bill 3092. As has already been discussed, on Monday of last week, we launched our statewide donor registry, and that is a very exciting accomplishment for our organization, but also for the state of Oregon. In respect to time, I will not read my entire testimony. You have a copy, but I would like to talk about House Bill 3092, where it outlines that the role of the registry is limited to one, and share with you that Donate Life Northwest has been highly committed since the very beginning of our existence of 1975 to avoid duplication and to work in a combined collaboration for the state of Oregon. And for the past 2 years, we have worked in collaboration to develop this statewide registry. We have worked with the procurement organizations that have been mentioned today, Pacific Northwest Transplant Bank, the Community Tissue Services, the Lions Eye Bank of Oregon. We have also positioned ourselves so that we can support this registry in the way that needs to be supported in being able to get out the message. Most people, and now that we have 1 week under our belt, most people consider and think about donation with their D on their driver's license, and our main message will be and has to be, that's not enough. We have nearly 1.5 million Oregonians with a D on their driver's license. Donate Life Northwest and our volunteers, as well as our partners in the community, will motivate citizens to take the next step, and that's to go online and make that registration. As you already heard today, that is viewed as informed consent. The D on the driver's license will still be looked at as an intent. It will involve family, but most importantly, we are now giving citizens the opportunity to confirm their commitment by doing the informed consent on the registry. House Bill 3092 reinforces that, and that is why we are so much in favor of this bill, and particularly in the past years that we have looked at our Anatomical Gift Act and have continued to upgrade it as well as keep it in line nationally. I appreciate your time and welcome any questions.
Thank you. Questions? It doesn't seem like we have any, but if we come up, you're not going too far. So thank you for your testimony. I appreciate that. Mr. Heinle?
And Mr. Seeley, if you could come back up, I also have a question for you. And I might just ask you really quickly to think about it. The question I have is, any anticipated opposition to any of the changes? So just think about that. Is there something we should be looking for when we read through this? Mr. Heinle.
Hi, Madam Chair and the committee. My name is Robert Heinle. I'm the Director of Community Tissue Services in Portland. And I think Mary Jane set a good standard. You've got my written testimony. You can read it. I do want to call your attention to the fact that the bill, prior to revision, is obviously working for us. We recovered 186 tissue donors when I started in 1996, and last year we did 650 tissue donors. It is working. I think this bill is only going to strengthen things and make things work better. So that's my testimony and my full support behind this bill as amended. And I welcome any questions as well.
Thank you for your testimony. And maybe ask you the same question. And there may be no opposition to any of this, but I'm just wondering if there's any contentious points that we should just be aware of as we're reading through this. So either one of you.
Sure. Madam Chair, members of the committee, actually, through the expert guidance of Mr. Shetterly, and having we got very organized early on to take a pulse of what were some of the conflicts that could come our way. And there were two. And they've been previously amended before the present form, and there's another amendment that was referred to today, which I believe is the second, the additional amendment. The first was that there was some opposition around the United States from coroners and medical examiners, because there was original language that would require that stated they could not refuse a donor, which generally, in our experience, they don't. But if they did, they had to show up in the operating room. It was quite punitive. I was opposed to that nationally. It really came out of some experiences on the East Coast. And we very proactively got together with our state medical examiners and took amended that and to make it more congruent with our practice and our collaboration, where, you know, there has to be some middle ground there to preserve forensic evidence. There is a rare circumstance in which a donation may need to be denied. It seems like a tragic thing. It rarely happens, but when it does, it's for a good reason, because we want to preserve the ability for gifting in a larger way in the future and not be polarized in relationship with a very key component of the delivery of services here in the state. So we proactively dealt with that. I think we have some of the most progressive language in our bill, as recommended by the National Commission. The other was a minor conflict with advanced directives, which a reporter on the East Coast felt that it was not written well enough in the form that it came to us for adoption. So Mr. Shetterly, to Representative Greenwick, offered some amendment to balance there was a problem viewed, which I think is very remote, between the rights or the events of advance directives and the act of donation. And it really depends on your interpretation. In 23 years of being involved in donation, I have yet to see an advance directive interfere or be in conflict with the act of donation, because frankly, at the time of donation, we're working with that family and those individuals who have that responsibility. So the language was adjusted as recommended by the commission, and thoughtfully, Mr. Shetterly helped us bring that forward so that we could avoid conflict. Otherwise, unless Mr. Heinle has any, or anyone else, I don't see anything that necessarily could be a problem. I think we've warned off, what's the word?
support?
We've avoided what could be national attention, because if we hadn't made some of those amendments, then we could be a target by media. Doesn't mean that we wouldn't still, but we're going to be in the first group, hopefully, if this is successful and accepted and taken forward. Idaho is the first state to pass this revision, and there are a few other states where it's waiting the governor's signature, but we're early on. The goal is to have at least 20 or 30 states do this, and the idea is to have uniformity around the country, because I could be in another part of the country, and it would be nice if everybody's operating from the same sheet of music.
Thank you. I see you nodding your head, sir.
Madam Chair and committee members, the only thing I can add is that the proof of the resolution of the ME's weigh-in is Dr. Gunson's endorsement there. So,
thank you, and that puts that in context, so thank you. Appreciate that. Representative Greenlee.
Thank you very much. First, I want to put on the record, I'd love to take credit for anything that happened in this bill, but all I did was facilitate Mr. Shetterly's involvement. My question is there anything in this bill that helps solve the problem we talked about with the bill just before?
Madam Chair, Representative Greenlick, I think we're talking about two separate spheres. It's a very emotional, the previous issue we were talking about actually was pretty charged. And I welcome the suggestion that particularly Representative Bruin suggests that at the time that a task force would get together, we'd want to make sure that there's voice at the table. I am supportive because I think we all should be accountable and transparent. So I think even though our agencies are very regulated, we need to put that on the table. There's another Senate bill, actually, 341, that speaks to some state registering of our agencies with the state. The Anatomical Gift Act, in my view, I think is not specific to the issues that are being brought up in this body. They're kindred, just because we're talking about anatomical gifts, but we're really two domains there. Different focuses. I don't mean to give you any. The answer is no. No, I think they're separate issues. In my view, and I'll contemplate that to see if I have missed something. So.
I think the origin of what we're talking about is the same, but two different uses. And
whole body is addressed in the Anatomical Gift Act historically because that is an option that people have to donate their whole bodies to medical schools. So it has always been spoken of, and it's reasonable to contemplate that.
Thank you. Mrs. Mackey, for the record, just state your name again.
Yes, my name is Rachel Mackey, and thank you, Madam Chair, and the committee. And I don't know if this is procedurally correct, but I did have a comment on the previous bill, and it was simply the contrast between what I heard described, which was pretty horrific, and with my own experience in dealing with the federally regulated organizations that handled my son. We had a unique experience with my son. He worked in a bakery in Portland, and there was a customer there that really liked him a lot. She was the technician that was called to do the cornea removal after his death. She does that for the Lion's Eye Bank. She was given the option of, you know, certainly not participating. And she chose to. She said, no, I need to take care of this one. And I can't tell you what that does for me, to know how much love and how much care he had all the way through that process. And the contrast between that and the testimony earlier is just considerable. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you for that additional testimony. I appreciate that. Any final questions for the panel? We'll move on to our final bill. Thank you for being here today.
Thank you.
And we will come back on work session on this bill after we've had a chance to review it. And if that's all right with the committee, I think we need to just read through everything and then get back to it. But thank you very much.
Thank you.
With that, we'll close the public hearing on House Bill 3092.
And open a public hearing on House Bill 3331. Representative Gelser. Sandy, what's our final bill?
Madam Chair, members of the subcommittee, House Bill 331, chief sponsor is Representative Gelser at the request of Chris Chapman. This bill is establishing a personal income tax credit for individuals donating certain transplanted organs during a tax year, limits the credit to lesser of 50% of a personal income tax liability or $1,000. It applies to transplant operations incurring in tax years beginning on or after January 1, 2008 and before January 1, 2013. This does have a subsequent referral to revenue.
Thank you, Sandy. And Representative Gelser.
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, I'm Sarah Gelser, the state representative from Corvallis and Philomath, which is House District 16. And I will be brief because Chris Chapman, who is the author and the inspirer of this bill, is here, and she can speak to this more clearly. But basically what this bill does is it establishes a personal income tax credit for individuals, living individuals who make a living donation of an organ, so an individual that primarily is donating a kidney to a friend or a loved one or someone that they know that needs that. This is a very modest tax credit. The maximum amount would be $1,000. The purpose of this isn't to induce people to donate their organs so that they can get a tax credit. The point of this is to help individuals with the expense that they incur when they make this extremely generous and selfless gift. As you can imagine, the recovery time is very difficult. There's time that's needed off work. There's some caregiving that's involved. This certainly won't meet all of the expenses that a person incurs, but hopefully this is something that could help them out a little bit with those. Representative Bruin and I serve on the Revenue Committee together, and he can attest that I'm a little bit stingy when it comes to letting go of tax credits, but this one I think is very important. And I would also point out, we certainly don't have a revenue estimate yet, but given the fact sheets that were on the previous testimony that talked about 103 total donors living and not living in 2006, the maximum revenue impact in that year would have been $103,000, which seems like a very modest thing to do for those who are giving so much to those who need it. Happy to answer any questions, but otherwise would turn it over to Chris, who can describe this better.
Thank you. Questions for the representative? Thank you for helping bring the bill today to the committee. So,
thank you.
Chris wants to come up. Ms. Chapman, it's good to see you.
Good to see you. And just as an aside, before I get started with my testimony, I did sign up for the registration they were talking about earlier. I was one of those 1,100 people last week that signed up, and it's very easy, very quick. Takes about 5 minutes. So,
good.
Just name you'd like
record.
To know.
Sorry, before I forget.
Yes.
Yes, we should all actually sign up. So.
It's very easy to do. It really does not take very long at all, and you have a number of choices. Anyway, yeah. That was that bill. Chair Kotek, members of the committee, my name is Chris Chapman, and I live at 2451 Southeast Yamhill Street in Portland. Thank you for this opportunity to testify in support of House Bill 3331, which would provide a tax credit to people who donate organs. I affectionately like to call my bill the Organ Kidney Plan, or OKP for short. Early in 1999, I learned my friend Desiree had been diagnosed with kidney failure due to a birth defect and would be undergoing surgery to remove her kidneys. Soon after that, she would start dialysis, which would continue until she died or received a kidney transplant. After months of paperwork, doctor's appointments, phone calls, and scads of blood tests, I was approved to donate a kidney to Desiree. Additionally, because I was self-employed at the time, I needed to raise money to be able to afford taking 3 months off work. A year and a half later, I began working here at the Capitol and began thinking of ways to make the journey easier for those who might be in similar situations. The idea I came up with was a tax credit. Since 2003, I have submitted a concept like this one, a tax credit, in each session. I have since found out that several states have passed concepts like this one. Other states, including Wisconsin, who is the first state to pass such legislation, do use a different methodology for calculating the credit. They allow up to a $10,000 deduction from gross income for expenses like travel, hotel, and lost wages incurred. I have no objection to changing the way in which the credit is determined. My original purpose and my only purpose was to save donors the hassle of dealing with receipts and reimbursements. I have attached some information in the packets given to you folks about the Wisconsin bill, a copy of the Wisconsin Act, and a fact sheet with information regarding the other states that have similar legislation to this. While this may not be the most earth-shattering piece of legislation that you consider this session, it would be of great importance to some Oregonians. It could be the little bit that allows more people to donate, and that is my agenda with this bill. This bill does not benefit me personally in any way. My hope is that it will benefit and ease the way for countless other Oregonians. Chair Kotek, members of the committee, I hope you will give this bill your support, and I'm happy to answer any questions. Good bill should pass. Thank you.
Thank you, Chris. I have just one quick question, just so I make sure I'm reading this correctly.
Yes, ma'am.
It applies specifically to donation of a single kidney or partial liver.
Yes, ma'am.
Okay. And
if you wanted to expand on that, I think that'd be great.
That well.
But sort of as a starting place, I believe those are the two most common.
And given the statistics we saw, even all the donations that were made, only a portion of those would be
correct.
And thank you for making that contribution, that donation. We heard in a different committee that, unfortunately, an individual had passed away after doing that. It has its dangers. So,
yeah.
Thank you. Questions for Ms. Chapman?
Okay.
Yes, Representative Bree.
First, thank you, Madam Chair. I was going to ask the sort of the same question that the Chair asked, which is why only kidney and partial liver? And
start there.
Okay. And I don't know how much of an expert. I know you're somebody who's experienced it firsthand, but I don't know how much of a medical expert you are to be able to determine. I mean, I think one of the things that we would look for in this bill, which I'm proud to co-sponsor, is those things that are particularly onerous, as you could well demonstrate. You know, giving a kidney is particularly onerous.
3 months off work.
Yeah, 3 months off work. I'm not, you know, things like bone marrow transplants, I'm not sure. I mean, I know they're painful. I'm not sure how long one is off. But anyway, it's just, I guess I'm not looking for an answer, just commenting. If we have somebody come back, you know, a year from now saying, well, why didn't you think of me? Well, that's something else. So, the other question I would have, and you alluded to it in your testimony, and I'm, once again, not sure if it's something you've considered and might be appropriate for an amendment of some sort. But, you know, it's particularly timely because I'm doing my taxes last week and looking at the running tax returns and looking at, you know, credits and deductions and everything else. What is the test, or what do you envision as the test for this? I mean, okay, so
to get the tax credit?
Exactly. I mean, is it something that you have to have in a some sort of, I mean, obviously you could prove it if it were ever come back to you. I'm sure you could get, you know, hospital documentation that shows that you're a donor. Is that what you have in mind? So you would check the box, if you will, and if the state of Oregon ever wanted to come back a couple of years from now or next year and say, well, let's just check this, you could be able to supply them information at that point, but you don't necessarily have to include the information with a tax return. Is that?
Sure.
Is that what you're thinking of?
I really, the way those details get, Representative Bruin, Chair Kotek, the way those details get worked out makes not very great difference to me. I basically wanted to make it as easy as I could, which is why I went with a half tax, you know, half of your owed tax or $1,000. But in looking at, and the reason I included this about the $10,000 deduction is that looking at the way other states do it, it does seem easier to copy the other states. And there, my vision of this would be that you take one of the many pieces of paper you get from the hospital and you attach it with your Oregon tax returns, and that right there, that piece of paper was enough to get you one half or $1,000. But depending on if you went to $10,000 and receipts and that sort of thing, to me those were just details, and I was going to let the experts work that out because I don't really know that much about revenue per se.
And Madam Chair, I would just follow up, if I may, real quick on that. I think it's good. I mean, you're right. Collecting receipts is not probably the best way to handle it, but having something from a hospital or whomever that just shows you did that. I mean, this unfortunately, the state of Oregon doesn't have the resources to audit or to even call half the time and ask the question. So, you know, unfortunately, I wish we didn't have to think this way, but we have to think about unscrupulous people who check the $1,000 tax return or tax credit because, hey, it's a $1,000 tax credit. So.
Right. And in that sense, I see where the receipts and reimbursement only for costs incurred does make a lot of sense. I'm not opposed to that. Mm-hmm. I was just going the easier way to start with.
There's that energy tax credit where you, you know, if you buy a refrigerator or something, you send the paper in to some state agency, they send you back a document that you can imagine something like that, but it seems like more trouble than it's worth.
Yeah, you don't want it to be a lot of trouble. You're taking on somebody who's already been troubled and has given a lot. You don't want to make it more onerous, but I also think you have to have some check and balance in there.
Well, I think that's something if we refer to revenue could, because they deal with these all the time, though you do make reference to showing some kind of verification. Mr. Seeley, did you want to, I see you waving, but you come up here a second, because, well, I'm just wondering if there's particular paperwork so we can get on the record that might be useful for the Revenue Committee to know about.
For the record, mm-hmm. Michael Seeley from the Transplant Bank. Living donation is tracked by the federal government. Mm. So we're required as a transplant center at OHSU, for example, to submit data on every living transplant. So you could have a pretty, I'm just thinking, and I'm sorry I wasn't aware of your bill, you could actually line up the numbers because the living donor has to be registered. Mm. So if you saw that you had 1,000 people in 1 year who donated their kidney.
There'd be a lot of kidneys
flying
around.
Well, I can tell you, that doesn't happen.
Yeah, when it was 100 the year before,
there'd be a little mechanism that, and that's public. That's actually, you can go on the internet. That's all public domain, the scientific registry, where you can look at the number of living donations. And there's some data that was on the back of my testimony previously about living donations. Living donations are very important. Complication rates actually are very low for the donor. Not, I think we've heard previous testimony that they're high, they're actually low, and it's an important part of transplantation. It makes up sometimes half the transplants that happen. So there's ways. I think you could have a little barometer that says, "Woo, we're out of line here."
Madam Chair,
does that make sense?
I'd like to apologize to the committee. It's in part beginning on line 28 of the bill, which I hadn't seen yet. So. It addresses the concern directly.
Talks about adding housework. But it's good to know that Department of Revenue, if we wanted to either make an assessment of how much it might cost and could trade. The data is available, which is good to know.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Seeley.
Thank you.
Representative Bonamici?
Oh, thank you, Madam Chair. My comment is moot. it's just, we have this issue whenever there's a tax credit or deduction that somebody may try to cheat on their taxes, and I submit that there are probably more useful areas we could focus on getting tax cheats than people who may donate their organs.
Except when the same guy has 4 years in a row of kidney donations.
That would be a problem, wouldn't it?
Representative Gelser?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just wanted to thank Chris again for bringing this bill. This is something that Chris has worked on for several sessions, and for obvious reasons, it's very personal to her. And through this process, I've learned that Chris is not the only person that's part of the building community that is an organ donor, a living organ donor, and that has been a very interesting and exciting thing for me to learn about, and I certainly appreciate the gift that you've given and your work to help make it possible for other people to receive those gifts and to make it a little bit easier for them when they step up to do that. And with that, I know that we're scheduled for a work session, and I'm wondering if it's possible if we can move it.
Yes, we will. With final questions for Ms. Chapman? Seeing none, thank you for being here.
Thank you very much for your
determination year after year. With that, we'll close the public hearing on 3331 and open a work session on 3331. I am interested in moving this to the full committee. I think anything we can do to raise awareness around this issue is important, even if that just means another committee hearing. But I think the basics of this bill are sound. The Revenue Committee obviously would work into additional details, but I would entertain a motion to move this to the full committee.
Madam Chair, I would move House Bill 3331 to the full committee with a due pass recommendation.
Thank you, Representative Gelser. Representative Gelser has moved House Bill 3331 to the full committee with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion? Aaron, would you call the roll?
Aye.
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 Aye. Aye. And with that unanimous vote, we will move it on to the full committee with a due pass recommendation. Thank you. Representative Gelser, would you like to carry to the full? Thank you. With that, we'll close the work session on 3331. And I'm going to open a work session on House Bill 3092. I know we need time to look this over, but given the testimony, I was wondering if the committee would be interested in moving this to the full committee, because I think, just judging from the testimony and how well it's been worked, it might make sense to have the next discussion with the full committee so that we can move it along quickly. I'm just throwing that out there, so I wanted to see what people thought about that. Unless, or how soon people would like it back is the other question. So I wanted to make sure we could talk that over. Representative Flores.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I don't have a problem moving it to full. My concern is, and perhaps the discussion did ensue when I had stepped out, but to kind of have an itemization of what the dash ones and the dash twos do accomplish, and that's what I would like to more fully get.
Okay.
What I was trying to go through is remain context and still listen, so I wasn't multiplexing very
and
well.
That seems fair. Maybe we could and if Sandy could do that, because this is fairly technical, so that's a good suggestion. Any other comments? How quickly people might want it back?
Yeah, I don't have a problem moving it to the full committee as well. I would think, I don't know if it's been done, and maybe it's already been done and they declined to show up, but I think a phone call should be made to these two entities since they were mentioned time after time after time.
I was thinking of the Uniform Act, not the
task force.
Oh,
I'm sorry. Then I withdraw all my comments.
But is there anyone else you would like to hear from on this? Because otherwise we'll just schedule for another work session after we've had a few minutes, you know, a few days, maybe next week, because we're trying to get things wrapped up. We can get a summary.
Mm-hmm.
But anyone else that we needed to hear from, we can talk with Mr. Shetler later. Okay. With that, I'm going to close the work session. I just wanted to get a sense of where people are at. Close the work session on 3331. And... I'm sorry. Close the work session on 3092. Sorry, wrong bill. Yes, Representative Gilson.
I had a general question for the good of the order. Are we starting to meet on Wednesdays in the full committee now?
Sandy, can you fill us in a little bit?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, at our little powwow that we have on Mondays, Chair, Vice Chair, the original email of starting like tomorrow as a full, because there were some concerns with this subcommittee having to meet on an opposite day, the counter recommendation was Mondays instead of a Wednesday. I have not sent out an email. However, at this juncture, there may only be one day that the full may need to meet before our 30th deadline, and that would be Monday the 24th. I will send out an email for you folks looking at your calendar. Wednesdays apparently were out. The only other option we had to schedule a second full would be on a Monday from 3 to 5. And that's just to deal with the workload or any leftovers so that we meet all of our deadlines for our first chamber bills. So the answer is no, but yes. We're not starting on the 11th, but we are going to be looking at another time in April.
So it would probably be good to at least maybe just hold that Sunday 3 to 5 on Monday the
23rd.
Because we are coming up on some deadlines in terms of moving bills out of committee House bills. We're going to try to hold on the Senate bills at this point and try to get through the House bills that have been scheduled and heard. We have some other things coming up as well, so thank you for that question. Any other comments, questions for the good of the order? Seeing none, we're adjourned.
Right on.